Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dadgum government, you saw it so and so's. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you get down, get down, get down, government?
Well, welcome to Handling the Truth with the Rebel Madman and Tenacity. And Mike Getty, how are you doing this evening?
Hey, doing wonderful, Terry. I hope you are.
I am, and I appreciate you refreshing my my thoughts about Red Beckman. This is such a great experience that I had, and it's also how you and I got to meet, actually, was on walls in our minds with Red, and man, those are memories that just I'll never forget. That every time we do one of these, he's fresh on my mind, and I do, like you said, I pray that that we're doing him right, because he certainly paved the way for what we're doing here many years before I got started in it, and we need to create that record and be available, and that's what we're doing here at Handling the Truth. We are being available, and hopefully this is creating a good record. Mike, I'd like to open us with a prayer, and that was something Red always thought we should do at the beginning of a show, and every time we fail to do that, you know, we had technical difficulty or something would go wrong. I mean, we would stop and we would actually, you know, say a prayer and things would seem to smooth out. And I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me whenever I've gotten a project, like working on a car or doing something construction, whatever. You just beat your head against the wall and then you stop and you turn to the Father and to Yahshua, our Messiah, and things smooth out. So let's do that right now. Almighty Father, you created it all, and we know that only you are good because only you can sustain us eternally. And Father, we lift up our listeners to you. I lift up Mike Getty to you. We lift up our families to you. We're certainly going through some trying times, and we know that your hand is at work. We know that you can make good come out of all of the bad, and we're just thankful that you're there and that we can turn to you and that we can rely on you and we can listen to you and follow your lead and follow the example of your Son. Father, we pray for the United States. We lift up Donald Trump to you. He claims to be a believer, and you know, there's a lot of things that we could say and assumptions we could make, and we don't want to do that, Father, because he's the President of the United States, and we need his leadership. We need you to guide him. So we ask, Father, that you open his eyes, that he might see and know the truth around him, and that he can identify the deception, and that he not take us down the wrong path. Father, we pray that your Spirit would fill him and awaken him to your truth, and that you would cause him to do things in a way that would help this union of states. We pray that he would not be a tyrant, that he would not cooperate with the deep state, even covertly. Father, we pray that he would be transparent, and that this administration will prosecute those who are your enemies, but they are especially enemies of the people. And we pray that you would stop the genocide. We pray that you would, every time a mainstream media person tells a lie, Father, we pray that you would have them choke on it, that they would become tongue-tied, that the politicians would stumble on their own words when they do not speak the truth. So I pray for our listeners tonight. I pray that this message is pleasing to you, and we just ask you to be with us through this show, this program. In the name of your Son, our Savior, Yahshua HaMashiach, we pray. Amen. Well, Mike, we're going to try to pick up. Last week we launched off onto the current events and trying to give people a warning about what's really going on, and ended up taking the whole show. So we kind of got to take a step back and pick up where we left off. You started telling us about the difference between the anti-federalist and the federalist, and that how people really need to be careful with the use of the term founder. And where do you want to go tonight with this lesson, Mike?
And, going through the public fool system like most everyone else has, I don't think we ever really did anything more than scratch the surface of the story of the founding of this country, and especially the personalities. I know in my high school curriculum, and even on into advanced education, everything centered around events or dates. And we didn't develop, in my mind, at least the characters weren't developed. And then I remember when I first got into it myself and started doing the research and started going through source documents, one of my first questions was, well, who are these anti-federalists? Man, I haven't heard about them. I heard them mentioned, but nothing was taught about them. And so who were they, and what kind of person would have opposed this allegedly wonderful Constitution that we have? What would possess someone to do that? And then I guess my first question was, after reading a number of letters between those we call founders, and I saw that many of them referred to Patrick Henry as the most devout Christian among the founders, and they cited example after example. And I thought, well, wow, we have a Constitution that was divinely inspired, but the most devout Christian among the founders opposed it stronger than anyone else. So that created a question in my mind, and I'm thankful for that question, because it led me to do even more research and to go into much deeper research to find out who these anti-federalists were. And then as I got into that research, I saw that for over 100 years in this country's academic history, not one history book was written that mentioned or included the anti-federalists. So for 100 years, no one was taught anything about the anti-federalists. You have to ask yourself, why was that? And then the thing came out in the 1950s. The first book or paper that was written about the anti-federalists was basically titled The Men of Little Faith. And so I spent probably several months doing basically a dive into who were these anti-federalists and why did they oppose this Constitution and on what grounds, because I think it's important that we know why would these people, who were they, and why would they oppose this Constitution. So that ended up being something that I just truly, truly, truly have enjoyed. And I looked at names when I looked at anti-federalists. I looked at a lot of names I didn't know, hadn't heard of before, hadn't been taught about. And then one of the things that struck me was the Federalists, the three men who wrote the Federalist Papers were Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. John Jay wrote very few. but Hamilton wrote the most, and then Madison wrote quite a few as well. And so I looked at the Federalist, and I looked at the other people who were called Federalist, and you have to remember, they gave themselves that name. Actuality, they were not Federalist. And that was called out by an anti-Federalist who wrote by the name A. Farmer. And he said that the real Federalists were the anti-Federalists and the Federalists were monarchists. And I thought it was ironic that the Federalists named themselves Federalists and then named anyone who opposed them anti-Federalists. And most of the anti-Federalists didn't like that name. They very much opposed being called anti-Federalist. And you can imagine for a group of men who basically, and one woman who stood for federalism, were being called by the opposing group anti-Federalist. So it looks like the marketing procedure and giving different images of your opponent back then was quite popular. One of the people that I really, really have enjoyed studying, and quite a paradox, and that is Luther Martin. And Luther Martin was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention of 1787. He left in late August, never to return. He didn't sign the Constitution. And so I wanted to know who Luther Martin was. And so I got some facts here that I would like to share, and that was Luther Martin was born in New Jersey in 1748, and he graduated from what is now Princeton University with honors at the age of 18. And then he promptly moved to Maryland to teach, study for the law, became a lawyer, a position he used on multiple occasions to prosecute loyalists who were opposing the Minutemen and the others who wanted who were basically the people who fought to make this a separate country and to separate from England, and they were called the loyalists. And Martin very much loved to prosecute them in his position, and he was a strong advocate for the independence of the colonies. There are quite a few interesting facets about Luther Martin, about his life. And one of those, which I spent quite a bit of time delving into, was he and Thomas Jefferson just absolutely did not get along. And it was a personal difference, not a philosophical difference. On philosophical terms, they were very much alike. And so I thought I would do some deep background studies and go into the libraries at the University of Maryland and try to find out. Interest was piqued. Why did he not get along with Jefferson? And I found out that Jefferson wrote a book called Notes on the State of Virginia. And, of course, if you would be interested in purchasing that book, I saw it on sale today on eBay for $8,000. So, perhaps someone would be interested in that book. But in that book, Jefferson relayed stories that he had been told by various people about Virginia in its early days. And in one of those episodes in the book, he wrote of a commander of an army that had massacred some Indians. And unfortunately, the gentleman he erroneously accused of massacring some of the Indians in the area happened to be Luther Martin's father-in-law. When the book came out, Luther Martin's wife had died, and Luther Martin was very much upset that his wife's father had been castigated by Thomas Jefferson and falsely accused of murdering several Indians. So he confronted Jefferson with this fact, and Jefferson went back to his sources and double-checked his sources and found out that he had, in fact, erroneously used the wrong person. And he tried to explain that to Luther Martin, but I think the damage was done, and Luther Martin did not seem to ever forgive Jefferson for that. And, you know, that's human nature, I guess, for some people. But defended in his career, he ended up defending people whom Thomas Jefferson decided to prosecute in various pursuits. And one of them was the impeachment of a Supreme Court justice named Samuel Chase, who was also from Maryland. And Chase had been a delegate along with Luther Martin to the Constitutional Convention. And Luther Martin also defended Aaron Burr in a trial. And so that, to me, was very interesting. And I think one of the things that we fail to do when we teach history is to put some character and to bring them and their strong points and their weak points and their human failures and their human successes. And I think if teachers did this much more often, we'd have more people more interested in the pursuits of studying about our founding and actually getting to know these people. But in late May of 1787, Luther Martin and four other people from Maryland were commissioned, including Samuel Chase and Carroll, were commissioned as delegates to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. Because of short notice and performance of his attorney general duties in Maryland, Luther Martin was a few days late arriving in Philadelphia, but he immediately became concerned with the proceedings there because of the rules that had been established before he arrived. And fortunately for us, we have Martin's words addressing those concerns, and I will quote from those. And that is, quote, "Before I arrived, a number of rules had been adopted to regulate the proceedings of the convention, by one of which seven states could proceed with the business, and which meant that consequently four states, the majority of that number, might eventually have agreed upon a system, the whole union. By another rule, the doors were to be shut and the whole proceedings were to be kept secret. And so far did this rule extend that we were thereby prevented from corresponding with gentlemen in the different states upon the subjects under discussion at the convention. A circumstance, sir, which I confess I greatly regretted. I had no idea that all of the wisdom, integrity, and virtue of this state, meaning Maryland, or of the others, were centered in this convention." So basically what Luther Martin was saying, why was all of the intelligence and everything in that convention, and why couldn't he discuss the proceedings with people he trusted back in his home state of Maryland? And, you know, this brings me to a question that was asked on June the 4th of 1788 at the opening day of the Virginia Ratification Convention, or the opening speeches, by Patrick Henry, when one of Patrick Henry's first questions to the entire group was, who gave the people, the 39 people who signed this Constitution, or the 55 who gathered in Philadelphia, who gave them the authority to write anything for we the people? Because we the people were not represented by those 55 people. And nowhere is that more poignant than in the state of Pennsylvania itself, because all seven delegates to the Pennsylvania Convention, or the Convention of 1787, all seven of them were from Philadelphia. The people in the rural parts of Pennsylvania were not represented in the Constitutional Convention at all. And all of the delegates from Pennsylvania were all merchants or attorneys. So the common man had no representation, and Patrick Henry made that quite clear in Virginia in 1787.
Mike.
But, yes, sir, go ahead.
I hate to break your stride. I just think it's important to help the listeners understand what it would be like if there was a constitutional convention today. What you just described, you know, is part of what, you know, the criminal conspiracy that actually went on. But the fact that when they got there, they made the rules after the convention was convened and the officers were selected. And the questions that I've got are this: is there anything in Article 5 of the Constitution, which is where it allows for the states to call or to not call, but request of the Congress to call for the Congress to call a constitutional convention? Is there anything in Article 5 that would prevent them from doing the same thing today as far as ignoring any instructions that the states gave their delegates, forming their rules behind closed doors, and having a secret convention like that? Is there anything that would stop them from doing that same thing today?
Absolutely nothing, Terry. And we all know, politics being what it is, the also Article 5 doesn't say who would select the delegates. It doesn't say if they could be appointed by the governor. And depending on what governor that you're talking about, can you just imagine the delegates that would be appointed from California or Michigan today? And the other point that you make, and a very valid point, is that once this convention was there and convened, they would make their own rules. And there's nothing in Article 5. Go ahead.
Including changing the ratification requirements.
Well, that's exactly what the first convention did, because the Constitution that they were operating under, which was the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, they were in effect at the time. So in 1787, these people sitting in Philadelphia were under the authority of the Articles of Confederation and its limitations. So anything that they did that exceeded that was invalid or should have been declared invalid. The first thing was Article 13 of the Articles of Confederation required that every state agree to everything that was proposed to make it valid, that all states had to agree, which constituted, from the Declaration of Independence, consent of the governed. Because
so this
nothing
is precisely,
in the Declaration. Go ahead.
So this is precisely what Luther Martin objected to and caused him to depart eventually.
Well, eventually, but there's several other things that occurred in between, and I think this is very critical. Martin was very, very strong on states' rights, and he strongly opposed the selection of the members of Congress based on population alone, which was the proposal initially by James Madison and the others who supported the Virginia plan, was that both houses of Congress would be elected by population. And he was very much upset with that, because that, as he enumerated, and I may get into that here later, but he wrote about it, and he said that basically if that was done, three states out of 13 would control the government. And so he very much opposed that, and he said that he believed that electing by population would tend to leave the powers of legislation in the states, as I said, with the most people. This was a very valid concern then, and it should be for us now. But that being said, the Congress of the United States has ignored the requirements listed in our Constitution of one representative for every 30,000 people. Today, we average one representative for every 776,000 people. Now, is there anyone who really believes that one representative can represent the interest, the varied interest, of 750,000 people?
And, it would be hard enough if it would be hard enough for one to represent 30,000 people.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, initially at the Constitution, they said 40,000, and George Washington objected very much to the 40,000, and it was reduced to 30,000. Well, during the course of time that Luther Martin spent at the convention, he would author what is called Article 6, Paragraph 2 of our Constitution, which we know today as the Supremacy Clause. Now, while fellow anti-federalist Samuel Bryan very adroitly points out in his essays that Paragraph 1 of Article 6 was written to cover the embezzlement of millions of dollars under the administration of Robert Morris, Philadelphia, as chief financial officer of the government from 1781 to 1785, paragraph of, or clause 2, if you will, dealt with other matters. Later in this convention, Luther Martin would become disgusted with the proceedings at Philadelphia, and along with his fellow delegate, John Francis Mercer, just walk out in protest. When the finished product of the Constitution was signed and then made public, Luther Martin would become upset and concerned at how the wording and intent of Article 6, Clause 2 had been perverted to mean something entirely different than what he had intended when he wrote that. Well, now let's go back for a second and remember that Luther Martin was the Attorney General for the state of Maryland for 30 years. That's a little bit unheard of in anybody's world today, but he had been the Attorney General for 30 years. Now, we know that the wording of Article 6, Clause 2 was changed. You and I also have discussed at length, Terry, and I hope we can discuss it with our listeners at some time, the Committee of Style. Because the Committee of Style, when the Constitution went from the Committee of the Whole to the Committee of Style in late August and early September of 1787, the Committee of Style took the liberty of changing the wording, changing, they completely composed the preamble, which was different from the preamble they had been sent. They just wrote a different preamble. And there is considerable evidence now, even before the Supreme Court, that Gouverneur Morris actually went in and made changes and actually took things out of the Constitution and put things into the Constitution that had been voted down during the convention itself. And like I said,
Mark,
hopefully we'll – sir.
Before I was a delegate for the 2009 Continental Congress, before I participated in that, I really didn't know what the heck a committee of style was or what their charge was or what they were supposed to do or not do. And as a result of witnessing what went on with that, I have a greater understanding. And I doubt very seriously that most of our listeners, you know, perhaps some, but I doubt most of them really understand what a committee of style does and what they're supposed to do and not do. You want to elaborate that, or you want me to keep talking about it?
Go ahead.
A committee of style really is consider someone correcting grammar or giving something a concise verbiage, presenting it in a way that it clearly presents the message or the conditions that have been voted on by the convention. It is not their job. It is specifically their job to not change the substantive meaning of what had been voted on and handed to them to stylize. The Committee of Style is to only address the style or the grammar or the clarity of the verbiage contained in the document that's given to them. So to change a substantive meaning is a direct violation of the charge of the Committee of Style. I'll leave it there. Go ahead, Mike, if that's okay.
Sure. Well, this is most interesting, again, not to be redundant, but Luther Martin was the attorney general, a very accomplished attorney, and he wrote Article 6, Clause 2. Pardon me. And in his later writings and public speeches, he would reveal that the Article 6, Clause 2 that he wrote or he authored, and stop and think about this in today's world, the way he set up the Supremacy Clause was that the Supreme Court of the United States in all cases would have a sitting jury. And according to Luther Martin, the Supreme Court would hold the trial with those judges. There would be a jury of the people who would have the final say-so. And according to Luther Martin, as he explained this to the legislature of the state of Maryland, he felt like that left the final decision upon the Constitution in the hands of the people where it belonged, and not to seven people or nine people, depending on the numbers at different times in our history, of unelected people serving for life. And this was very much opposed to what Luther Martin intended Article 6, Clause 2 to represent. And he said that the absence of that said jury for the Supreme Court gravely endangered freedom. Martin's intent for the Supreme Court was that it only be engaged when two state Supreme Courts ruled in a contradictory manner on the same issue, and then it be done for clarification only. Martin would vigorously oppose ratification of the Constitution of 1787, both in print and by the spoken word. He made an address to the legislature of Maryland, and because of telling them about why he opposed the Constitution. Now stop and think about this. Martin goes to the people who elected him to be a representative, and he goes to the legislature, and he explains to the legislature why he opposed ratification of the Constitution. Well, then he comes under fire and under severe castigation, even to name calling and other stuff from the Federalists, because they said he was violating their oath of secrecy and that he should not have been discussing what took place at the convention before the 50-year ban had expired. This was such a wonderful constitution. Why did the Federalists not want Luther Martin to explain to the legislature of Maryland why he opposed it? Luther Martin pointedly mentions why. Now, we have to go back here. Two other anti-Federalists from the state of New York both left the Constitutional Convention on July the 10th, and those were Robert Yates, who was a Supreme Court judge in New York, as was John Lansing Jr., was a Supreme Court judge in New York, and they both left the Constitutional Convention on July the 10th. And so Luther Martin is explaining to the delegates from the House of Delegates from Maryland why they left from his speech. And it was, "Sir, I flatter myself the subject of this letter will be a sufficient apology for thus publicly addressing it to you and through you to the other members of the House of Delegates. It cannot have escaped your or their recollection that when called upon as the servant of a free state to render an account of those transactions in which I had a share in consequence of the trust reposed in me by my state, among other things, I informed them that sometime in July, the Honorable Mr. Yates and Mr. Lansing of New York left the convention, that they had uniformly opposed the system, and that I believe, despairing of getting a proper one brought forward or of rendering any real service, they returned no more. You cannot, sir, have forgotten, for the incident was too remarkable not to have made some impression, that upon my giving this information, the zeal of one of my honorable colleagues in favor of a system which I thought it my duty to oppose impelled him to interrupt me, and in a manner which I am confident his zeal alone prevented him from being convinced was not the most delicate, to insinuate pretty strongly that the statement which I had given of the conduct of these gentlemen and their motives for not returning was not candid. That again, two delegates from New York. There were only three: Robert Yates, John Lansing Jr., and Alexander Hamilton. So Yates and Lansing leave on July the 10th. Shortly thereafter, Alexander Hamilton leaves, which leaves New York with no representation at the Constitutional Convention at all. So we come up with a constitution New York basically effectively had no part in. Because from that point forward, not having a quorum, Alexander Hamilton's vote, when he did come back, counted for nothing. They recorded his vote, but his vote counted for nothing. So Rhode Island sent no delegates to start with. They refused to even nominate delegates to go. So we're violating the Articles of Confederation because we have two states without representation at the Constitutional Convention. So that was a violation of the sitting constitution of the time. But anyway, continuing with Luther Martin's objections, he said, those honorable members have officially given information on this subject by a joint letter to His Excellency Governor Clinton. Indulge me, sir, in giving an extract from that it may stand contrasted in the same page with the information I have given you, and may convict me of the want of candor of which I was charged. If the charge was just, if it will not do that, then let it silence my accusers. And then he quotes from theirs, and it says, thus circumstanced, under these impressions, to have hesitated would have been to be culpable. We therefore gave the principles of the Constitution, which has received the sanction of a majority of the convention, our decided and unreserved dissent. We were not present at the completion of the new Constitution, but before we left the convention, its principles were so well established, convince us that no alteration was to be expected to conform it to our ideas of expediency and safety, a persuasion that our further attendance would be fruitless and unavailing rendered us less solicitous to return, unquote. And so Luther Martin then says, these, sir, are their words. On this I shall make no comment. I wish not to wound the feelings of any person. I only wish to convince. And he said, I have the honor to remain with the utmost respect, your obedient servant. Luther Martin also spoke against the outcry claiming the Articles of Confederation must be replaced by a new constitution because the articles lacked the necessary energy. That's what we were all taught. We had to get away from these Articles of Confederation because they didn't give the government enough power. People today should really cringe at that. But Martin would write eloquently of his objections using an allegory of Aesop, in which was drawn the image of the people being frogs, and those frogs trading their known log for an unknown crane which would devour them all. Has not Luther Martin's prediction come to fruition? So we look again, and I could quote that entire speech for you, but that would be a little bit redundant in many cases, but he does bring up the fable of Aesop. But here is something that I think that was really, in my mind, something else that I think was very critical. And two things also, as we talk about Luther Martin, two things also that I think that is that we must think about when we think about Luther Martin, and two things I hold him in the highest esteem for doing. And number one was Luther Martin's objections to the Constitution embracing of the physical slavery of the black race. And I will quote what he said, and it's a short quote, and I absolutely love this quote. And he said, and I quote, "The revolution," speaking of the revolution against England, "was grounded in defense of the natural God-given rights possessed by all mankind. But our Constitution was an insult to that God, who views with equal eye the poor African slave and his American slave master." Now, he said that during the convention. And so, and one of the other things, and I'll get on into that slavery later, but the other thing, and I think this is critical, and I think this exposes the fraud of the Federalists. And that was, again, stop and think about it. According to Alexander Hamilton, the delegates at the Constitutional Convention were composed of the wealthy and well-born. And that was his exact phrase, wealthy and well-born. So the common people were not represented at the Constitutional Convention. And stop and think, the first power they gave to Congress in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 was the power of unlimited taxation by unlimited means. Basically, what I'm saying is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 gave the Congress the ability to tax the American people up to and including 100% of anything they wanted by any means that they so desired. And no one spoke against that stronger than did Luther Martin. And I really want to quote this because I think it's very relevant in his opposition to unlimited taxation and the unlimited modes of taxation. And here's what he said, and I quote, "By the power to lay and collect imposts, they may impose duties on any or every article of commerce imported into these states, to what amount they please. By the power to lay excises, a power very odious in its nature, since it authorizes officers to go into your houses, your kitchens, your cellars, and to examine into your private concerns, Congress may impose duties on every article of use or consumption, on the food that we eat, on the liquors that we drink, on the clothes that we wear, on the glass which lights our houses, or the hearths necessary for our warmth and comfort. By the power to lay and collect taxes, they may proceed to direct taxation on every individual, either by a capitation tax on their heads or an assessment on their property. By this part of the section, therefore, the government has a power to lay what duties they please on goods imported, to lay what duties they please afterwards on whatever we use or consume, to impose stamp duties to what amount they please, and in whatever case they please. Afterwards, to impose on the people direct taxes by capitation tax or by assessment to what amount they may choose, and thus to sluice them at every vein as long as they have a drop of blood, without any control, limitation, or restraint. While all the officers for collecting these taxes, stamp duties, imposts, and excises are to be appointed by the general government under its directions, not accountable to the states at all, nor is there even a security that they shall be citizens of the respective states in which they are to exercise their offices. At the same time, the construction of every law imposing any and all these taxes and duties and directing the collection of them and every question arriving thereon, and on the conduct of the officers appointed to execute these laws and to collect these duties, so various in their kinds, are taken away from the courts of justice of the individual states and confined to the courts of the general government, where is to be heard and determined by judges holding their offices under the appointment not of the states, but of the general government," unquote. How did this man, how was he able to predict exactly what would become of the American populace, how we would be taxed at every angle to whatever extent they so desire? And he saw this very clearly and opposed it with the words I just read. Any thoughts on that, Terry?
When was the planks of the Communist Manifesto written?
I tell people this. It's my opinion, and I sell it for what it's worth. But I believe that Karl Marx used many of the principles found in our Constitution to establish the planks of the Communist Manifesto. And I'm thinking, 1848 is the date?
Right. I knew it was at least 50 years after Luther, you know, after what you just read was put in print, or, you know, that he wrote it or spoke it. Point is that what you just said is a good explanation. How do you subvert the Union of States? The Communist Manifesto spells that out, and what he predicted is one of the planks in the Communist Manifesto. That was my point.
Well, that, I think, is, and I have said this, and I've said this to students in the past, and I get people quite angry at times when I make this allegation, but I believe that we have people created with Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, I believe in so many ways, Terry, that we basically established a socialist government with our Constitution. And any time that the people can be taxed at no limit with and no limit form of taxation, which Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 provided, that there is, that is complete socialism from day one. And I certainly would be willing to hear how people say that it's not, because there is no limit to the taxation. And history has proved that to be correct. And the crazy thing about this is, Terry, was the fact that the American Revolution was fought over taxes, over the American public being taxed. And so then after we finally get our freedom from England in 1783, 4 years later, we impose a more heinous form of taxation than what we had under the king. And people, you know, love this thing and say, oh, isn't this great? Look at this wonderful Constitution. Thoughts?
Well, our parents and our grandparents were convinced that they were living in a free country. And they, you know, they passed that on to my generation, and I began passing it on to the next generation until I, you know, got into some doing my own personal research. And then, you know, one thing led to another, and you it's like one guy said on your one of the Facebook pages, it's hard to unsee what you've seen, right? Once you see it, it's kind of hard to unsee it. But, you know, I don't fault my parents or my grandparents for not seeing through this, because they just didn't know any better. You know, they wanted to keep a positive attitude. They wanted to be what was deemed patriotic, and they bought into a lie. And it's a painful process when you wake up to those lies and start to see what you didn't see before. And
well, Terry, if the anti-federalists were held out of the purview of the American public for 100 years, for whatever reason, I think the reason's obvious, and were not understood, I don't think we can blame our parents or grandparents at all. Because if you don't have knowledge or information, You make opinions and you make judgments on the knowledge that you do have. And to me, the people who kept that knowledge from our parents and grandparents are the culprits, and not our parents or grandparents, and saying, well, you know, they should have known better. The information was not available. One of the other things that I found strange about, well, I don't mean strange, but unusual about studying the Anti-Federalist, and, you know, I found this as just a, and then I went back and checked it. If you take the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist and compare their ages, Terry, the Anti-Federalist, who came from all walks, you had some people who wrote Anti-Federalist papers were so crude in their writing, nothing like Luther Martin or Samuel Bryan. But, I mean, it was crude. When you really get down and start studying, some of these people, they couldn't spell. Their punctuation was terrible, but they opposed the Constitution. But they came from all walks of life, whereas the Federalists were generally the wealthy and the well-born, as Alexander Hamilton said. So they established a government for the wealthy and the well-born. And in a letter from George Washington to John Jay, just a month before the Constitution began, Washington says to John Jay, well, you know, we're not sure that these people, the mass of people, are smart enough to know what's best for them. So therefore, we have the right to impose our imperial dignity and command obedience. Now, does that sound like people are looking out for the rights of other people? And people, if you don't believe that good old George Washington said that, go to, you can find it in the National Archives in a letter from Washington to John Jay. It's right there. Another letter from...
Sounds like the words of a dictator to me. No, it sounds like the words of a dictator to me.
Exactly, and you have James Madison in a letter to George Washington a month before the convention as well, stating that he wants to eliminate the states totally in any jurisdictional matters or any matters of importance except where they could be subordinately useful. So they wanted to eliminate the states, and there's reasons for that, because the states operating through the Articles of Confederation under Article 13 had blocked their attempts to come up with these massive taxation schemes and other things that they wanted to do. They had been blocked in the Articles of Confederation. So the Articles of Confederation were not bypassed because they were weak. They were bypassed because they were strong. And they didn't allow the Federalists to get by with all of these schemes that they wanted to do. But the huge thing is the Federalists were, the Anti-Federalist average being 10 years older than the Federalists. Now, can we equate 10 years of wisdom to the Anti-Federalists? I'm not sure we could blanket do that. But we sure could talk about the fact that 10 years of experience is critical, I think, in many ways. But, again, we talk about why do these Anti-Federalists matter? Why did Luther Martin matter when it comes to the Constitution of 1787 and his objections to the ratification of that instrument of government? Luther Martin provides a unique perspective from many of the other Anti-Federalists. He was an actual attendee at the convention in Philadelphia. It is true that some of the other Anti-Federalists were there too, such as Yeats, as we mentioned earlier, John Lansing Jr., and George Mason, who we haven't mentioned today. But Luther Martin actually got into the nuts and bolts of the convention with the legislature of the state of Maryland, which chose him as a delegate, which we also mentioned earlier. And he provided a perspective which others did not. We probably should take special note that Martin received severe criticism from the Federalists, again, something we've mentioned earlier, for violating the code of silence the delegates adopted. But thankfully, Martin had more devotion to his state and the people of his state than he did those who sought to keep their political machinations secret for 50 years. Martin, 32 years later, would caustically remind Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Marshall, of his attendance in Philadelphia. And this is one of the unique stories of our founding history. In McCulloch v. Maryland, Martin was the Attorney General for the state of Maryland still. This is 32 years after the convention. And during the Supreme Court hearing of McCulloch v. Maryland, Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice John Marshall lectured Luther Martin on the intent of the framers when they created this Constitution. And I think it was ironic that Luther Martin stood very quietly and was admonished by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court about what the intent of the framers were as the Constitution, as to what the Constitution meant. And at the end of the proceedings, one of the greatest put downs in history, in my opinion, was when Luther Martin said, "With all due respect, Mr. Chief Justice, I was there. You were not." So that one, I can only imagine. I would have loved to have been there to see the expression on John Marshall's face. So the Maryland legislature asked Luther Martin to provide them with the details of his attendance at the convention in Philadelphia. Now, if he would have held to the oath of silence, which was imposed on the others, and I might note that Robert Yates from New York and John Lansing from New York both kept their word. They didn't reveal a thing that happened there for 50 years. Of course, they were dead by then, but nothing was revealed during their lifetimes, and even their wives didn't reveal their notes until after the 50 years had passed. So some people held to that oath for whatever reason. They felt like they were obligated to it, like Yates. But Luther Martin felt like his devotion and that his faithfulness belonged with the people he represented from Maryland. I'll let the listeners make the choice of which way they would have decided to have gone on that issue.
Well, was he also not present? Was he not present when they took that oath?
No, Luther Martin was not there. I think I mentioned that in the beginning. He got there after it was done, but he was told of the oath and told that he could not communicate with the people back in Maryland about what they were doing. So he was not there the actual day they took the oath, and maybe that's a rationalization he used, Terry. Good point. But here was his address being called before the legislature, before I quoted from a letter, being called before the legislature, Luther Martin made this speech. He said, "Mr. Speaker, since I was notified of the resolve of this honorable House, that we should attend this day to give information with regard to the proceedings of the late convention, my time has necessarily been taken up with business, and I have also been obliged to make a journey to the Eastern Shore. These circumstances have prevented me from being as well prepared as I would wish to give the information required. However, the few leisure moments I could spare, I have devoted to refreshing my memory by looking over the papers and notes in my possession, and shall with pleasure, to the best of my ability, render an account of my conduct. It was not in my power to attend the convention immediately upon my appointment. I took my seat, I believe, about the 8th or 9th of June. I found that Governor Randolph of Virginia had laid before the convention certain propositions for their consideration, which have been read to this House by my honorable colleague, and I believe he has very faithfully detailed the substance of the speech in which the business of the convention was opened, for though I was not there at the time, I saw notes which had been taken. The members of the convention from the states came under different powers." The different powers, now that's unquote. "The different powers Martin spoke of are the authorizations from the states which provided delegates to the convention. Here it was established that there was no authorization to the delegates from their respective states to totally abandon the Articles of Confederation and to prepare an entirely new document of governance. Now, Terry, let's take this back again to what we're talking about, a constitutional convention. If this constitutional convention is agreed upon, and we do have a new constitutional convention, they are not bound. We spoke of this before. What would be their limitations under Article 5? There is nothing at all that would prevent this group from establishing a brand new constitution, just as was done in 1787. Because they would,
we've got a bunch of Federalists out here lying to people.
Oh, obviously. Obviously, Terry, that is why in 2011 this movement began at Harvard University, and the two chief suppliers of money were the Koch brothers and George Soros. Both sides of the aisle have been after this new constitutional convention, and that conference was held at Harvard University. I've got the minutes from it. And they decided in 2011, both sides, the Koch brothers being the quote-unquote conservatives, and Soros, we know, is a leftist Marxist. And so they had decided to get together to push both sides for a new constitutional convention. It's documented, and they had two or three meetings after that, which were all public. Those are all documented. And you're not going to see anybody on CNN or Fox News talk about those meetings. But they occurred, and they are documented. So the move for a new constitutional convention was from both sides. Very wealthy people on both sides want a new constitution. And ironically, the name given to the first convention was Constitution 2020. Now, does anyone imagine that somewhere between now and, let's say, if we get more coronavirus stuff going on, can anybody imagine that the powers that be might say, well, we have a constitutional crisis, so we need a new convention? The groundwork's already laid. They don't do these things without a purpose. And for, you know, Terry, if anyone contacts you and would like documentation of these meetings that took place, I'll be more than happy to provide them. But the delegates who went to, with the exception of New Jersey left their delegates open. There was no stipulations. The other states, the other 11 states, required that they gave the authority only to amend the Articles of Confederation. There was no grant whatsoever. Here's the thing that happened is that in the Virginia Ratification Convention on June the 4th of 1788, Edmund Pendleton admitted that they didn't have the power to do what they did. But he told Patrick Henry, now it doesn't matter. When Patrick Henry objected and wanted the minutes of the meetings that led up to the Constitutional Convention, Edmund Pendleton went into full bore, no, you're not getting them. And even if they did meet outside and act outside of their authority, now it's too late to worry about it. You think we might ever hear that again? Going back to what Luther Martin said to the legislature, and I quote again, the greatest number, I believe, under powers nearly the same as those of the delegates of this state. Some came to the convention under the former appointment, which was the Annapolis Convention, authorizing the meeting of delegates merely to regulate trade. Those of Delaware were expressly instructed to agree to no system which should take away from the states the equality of suffrage secured by the original Articles of Confederation, which was one state, one vote. So Delaware was specifically prohibited from it, but which was the first state to ratify the Constitution without reading it? They did the Nancy Pelosi approach. Let's pass it, and then we can find out what's in it. Martin then launched into a description of the rules that had been established before his arrival, which we talked about earlier. And then Martin details the objects of the Virginia plan as introduced by Governor Randolph from Virginia, but written at least 1 month prior to the convention by James Madison and transmitted to George Washington and Alexander Hamilton. Tensions of the elite, of the leading Federalists were an annihilation of the Articles of Confederation in direct violation of the authority by their respective states. Now, there's a description which Martin outlines how Virginia sought to gain more influence along with Pennsylvania and Massachusetts, the three most populous states at that time, in a plan wherein the states with the most population would achieve controlling interest in the government. Ironically, we are seeing the exact same dynamic in this country today with the move by various states to elect the president by popular vote, abandoning completely the Electoral College. We will turn the election of the president over to approximately 10 to 11 states, and I'll tell you, if this happens, there will not even be any campaigning in the other states because it won't matter. But here is what Martin had to say. The object of Virginia and other large states is to increase their power and influence over the others. Did not my observation. The subject, however, was discussed with great coolness in the Committee of the Whole House, for the convention had resolved itself into a Committee of the Whole to deliberate upon the propositions delivered in by the honorable member from Virginia, speaking of James Madison. Hopes were formed that the farther we proceeded in the examination of the resolutions, the better the House might be satisfied of the impropriety of adopting them, and that they would be finally be rejected by a majority of the committee. If, on the contrary, a majority should report in their favor, it was considered that it would not preclude the members from bringing forward and submitting any other system to the consideration of the convention. And accordingly, while those resolves were the subject of discussion in the Committee of the Whole House, a number of members who disapproved them were preparing another system, such as they thought more conducive to the happiness and welfare of the states. The propositions originally submitted to the convention, having been debated and undergone a variety of alterations in the course of our proceedings, the Committee of the Whole House, by a small majority, agreed to a report which I am happy, sir, to have in my power to lay before you. And so he laid before them what the Virginia plan was. And it's easy to discern from Luther Martin's description the subterfuge that was taking place at that convention and which will take place at another one, I promise you. Even aside from the obvious intention of leaving the restrictions of the Articles of Confederation in the heat and the dust of Philadelphia. Let's take a look at the proposals for the new government, which Martin spoke of in the previous comment. Number one, resolved that it is the opinion of this committee that a national government ought to be established, consisting of a supreme, legislative, judiciary, and executive. That the legislative ought to consist of two branches. That the members of the first branch of the national legislature ought to be elected by the people of the several states, for the term of 3 years to receive fixed stipends by which they may be compensated for the devotion of their time to public service, to be paid out of the national treasury, to be ineligible to any office established by a particular state or under the authority of the United States, except those particularly belonging to the functions of the first branch during the term of service and under the national government for the space of 1 year after its expiration. Was unique in studying this, Terry, that there were several delegates, including Martin and George Mason, who wanted the members of Congress to be paid out of the state that they represented and not out of the federal funds, not by the national government, because it was their contention that the delegates to the federal government would be much better controlled by their states if their salaries came from the states themselves. You got any thoughts on that?
Well, do you think? Well, yeah. I mean, by having it decided at the federal level, they get to vote for their own benefits. There's a conflict of interest, and if the states were the ones that selected, that decided on that and made the payments, then it's basically the states that hiring and firing. It retains a huge amount of control, and it prevents that conflict of interest.
Well, I thought it was very significant, and I enjoyed reading the debates where both Martin and Elbridge Gerry was involved in this as well, that Martin, Elbridge Gerry, and George Mason were very adamant that the pay should remain with the states, both for the senators and for the House of Representatives. And as you just articulated, being paid on the federal level gave them the power over their own purse strings, which if they had been paid by the states, they would not have had that authority, and the states would have retained much more say-so in how their various representatives voted.
Yeah, no question about it. And
so,
it's also true that the 17th Amendment, which was never properly ratified either, 14, 15, 16, 17. None of those four were properly ratified. Changed the. It took a big step towards being a pure socialist country. When they basically made it so that the wealthy could buy their seats. And I had a thought a little bit ago when you were talking, Mike, about what this pandemic is doing to us politically in this country, in this federation, I'd rather say, because it's going to make it even more difficult. This is really a form of class warfare, because it's going to make it harder for the grassroots candidate, the guy that doesn't have enough money to support his own campaign, that can write a check for $20 million like Polis, the governor of Colorado. It's going to be almost impossible for a little guy now who's going to be even weakened more economically and financially compared to those with the deep pockets. It's going to make it even more difficult, especially at the statewide level, to win a campaign for someone who is not a deep pocket.
No, I think that's been the intent from the beginning, Terry. And I remember as a resident of Colorado back in 14, when Michael Bloomberg came in and put enough money into the Colorado legislative races for state that he was able to get enough left-wingers in there to where they started coming up with these anti-gun provisions, which were opposed by the majority of sheriffs of the state of Colorado. And I know you were behind behind's a bad word, but very much involved in a recall of some of the senators who proposed that.
Well, he was the president of the Senate. It was John Morse that was
right.
The main crony for Bloomberg, and we recall him. It was the first time in the history of the state that a recall was successful at that level.
Well, I also
and it wasn't easy. It took a lot of work.
I remember that. If I may bounce back just a minute, I know we're getting close on time, but I would like to bounce back and to read exactly what the sitting Congress of the United States, their actual rule or their actual wording for the Constitutional Convention of 1787. Now, this came from the Congress that was in power at the time, the Congress under the Articles of Confederation. And here is, quote, their entire, this is what they said. that they were to send delegates for the sole and express purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation and reporting back to this Congress and the several state legislators such alterations and provisions therein as shall render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of government preservation of the Union. That's what these delegates were told to do when they went to Philadelphia. And the documentation is resplendent of people like Madison, Washington, and others planning before they ever left to go to Philadelphia to completely throw this away and do exactly what they wanted to when they got there.
Yep.
Evidence that the Federalists intended from the very beginning to ignore the mandates of Congress and to move forward an entirely new form of government can be found in a letter, and these letters are crucial to understanding what happened. Here's a letter from General Henry Knox to George Washington. And it says, if Washington attends the convention, or if as Knox said, he would no doubt be made its president. If the convention proposed only amendments to the Confederation, Washington's reputation will suffer. But if this convention proposed an energetic and judicious system with Washington's endorsement, that would be highly honorable, would enhance Washington's fame in the present and future ages, and entitle Washington to the glorious Republican epithet, the father of our country. It's a letter written before the convention, folks. Power-hungry Federalists ignoring the mandates of the sitting Congress in order to enhance one's fame and introduce an energetic and judicious system is seen by them as highly honorable. Now, do you think that delegates to a new convention in 2020 might consider their actions highly honorable as well, and that it might enhance their fame to come up with a new constitution?
Hmm.
So, as I said previously, most have never heard of the great oratory that was provided by Luther Martin at the convention. And in a most spirited defense of equal representation as to the representatives to the central government, Luther Martin believed, as did very few others, that electing representatives to the central government based on population was a disaster in the making. Martin saw that tyranny of the majority could be the worst tyranny of all. We now see that paradigm being played out with legislation in several states to do away with the Electoral College, which we mentioned before, and to elect a president by popular vote. Martin spoke for 2 days during the sweltering heat to an audience that was both rude and inattentive. Now, folks, when Luther Martin was trying to speak at the Constitutional Convention, he was jeered. Regardless, Martin's speeches required the Federalist Nationalist Monarchists to counter with their best orators. It is quite possible, had not Martin delivered his broadside attack on this terribly flawed principle, the states would have not had two senators at each, but a number of senators commensurate with their population. Of course, any federal properties contained in the original Constitution as pertained to electing senators was lost with the acceptance of the not constitutionally ratified, as Terry mentioned earlier, 17th Amendment. Another piece of specious garbage which is accepted by the people because the courts said it was when it wasn't. Thoughts, Terry?
Well, it's a lot to digest. I mean, I have way too many thoughts for, you know, to get it all out in 4 minutes. I'm really concerned. that what's going on right now is going to divide. I mean, we're seeing a demolishing of so many of the middle class right now. I mean, the financial power of the middle class in the United States has been significant. And if this pandemic didn't do anything other than diminish the financial strength of the middle class of the United States, which it already has, it would have already been, you know, pretty devastating and very beneficial for the Marxists out there, the fascist elite control freaks that think they are smarter and capable of what was the words of Washington about the dignity?
The imperial dignity.
Right.
And
it's certainly benefiting those people of that attitude, I'm greatly concerned what's happening right now. And people have to take a stand now. You know, there was a meeting in the town where I lived this afternoon of all the restaurant owners. They got together in private for a meeting of the restaurant owners, and I think they're about to. I pray they're about to take a stand and open back up and defy the police's tyrannical orders. And that's the kind of thing we need right now. We need people with a lot of courage and a lot of guts to be willing to put themselves at a little bit of risk in order to hang on to our rights and our freedoms.
Well, I couldn't agree more, Terry. And also, I found a quote by James Madison. I'll read very quickly because we talked about to impose their imperial dignity. James Madison said this. He said, "We need a central government which will have a veto or a negative in all cases whatsoever on the legislative act of all the states as heretofore exercised by our kingly prerogative."
Well, and this guy's put on a pedestal.
Yeah, so they speak of their imperial dignity and their kingly prerogative, and we salute them as the founders of the country.
You know, I think of all the times that I've quoted him, just like his comment about the power lying with the people, the ultimate power, ultimate authority lying with the people. How two-faced he was about it.
If you read Federalist, you will see how much he lied about all of the powers of government. And if I may finish up with the definition of bamboozle by Carl Sagan, one of the saddest lessons of history is this. If we've been bamboozled long enough, we tend to reject any evidence of that bamboozle. We are no longer interested in finding out the truth. The bamboozle has captured us. It's simply too painful to acknowledge, even to ourselves, that we've been taken. Once you give a charlatan power over you, you almost never, ever get it back.
Wow. That's a great closing comment, Mike. This has been a great lesson. I really enjoyed this, Mike. I always learn when I just kind of shut up and listen to what you've got to present, because we never got this from a textbook. We certainly never got it from any college or university or school that's run by the government. And I really appreciate this a lot. It certainly solidifies and affirms what we know to be true today. So, Mike, until next Thursday. Thank you very much. This has been a great lesson. This is Handle the Truth with the Rebel Madman. You can find Mike's articles at therebelmadman.com. And you should go read a lot, because he's made some great points, and you'll get a great lesson from just reading some of his articles at that website. So I wish everyone well for the next week. Take a stand. Remove the mask. And be vocal local. Have a great week, folks. Good night, Mike.
Good night, guys.
You dadgum government, you sorry rattle fratches. You got yourself an itch and you're wanting me to scratch it. Well, you dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Hey, boy. Shoe-fitting, fire-starting. Ought to tell you no good preambulatory bone frame and nail it to your government walls. All of you, you dadgum government, you...